Welcome to VI Talk, sharing ideas, information and support.
Hi everyone, it's Jo and I have with me Dawn.
Hello.
And it's a pleasure to invite to VI Talk for the first time Tom Walker, who is a visually impaired freelance journalist and communications specialist. Hiya Tom.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. Yourself?
Could be worse. The weather is terrible. The weather is terrible here in the northwest today. We got Storm Francis visiting us.
Oh, fabulous. So you're visually impaired, Tom. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself first and your visual impairment?
Yeah, I was born totally blind, in fact. And at the age of 3 and a half, after, I don't know, quite a number of operations, some sight, a small amount of sight was restored to my right eye. And I guess for me, I mean, I'm sure this is the same for other people, but I can actually remember being able to see for the first time. You know, most people obviously when they're born can't remember the process of being able to try and interpret what they can see, but I remember it quite clearly.
That must have been quite an experience.
Well, it was, because you know, you're sitting there looking at things thinking, wow, but what is amazing is how natural it is, really, and how instinctive and innate it is. I think looking back on it, you know, it was surprising just how quickly I could make sense of the world. I mean, we're talking literally a minute or two and started to just make sense of the world. No, oh, that's sunshine, that's a window, that's, you know, and so on and so on. You know, you kind of think, I think the rational mind thinks, oh, well, it must have been very difficult. People must have needed to tell you what things are. Mm-hmm. But actually, that wasn't the case for me. I just seemed to know what it was. And actually, I can remember as well in the hospital, it was Birmingham Children's Hospital. I can remember reading and seemingly pretty much able to read fairly quickly after gaining a bit of sight. So that was reading print. I mean, I use speech now an awful lot more because I'm lazy and it's hard work reading print, especially when you've got very low vision. So I use speech now, but I mean, I went through the whole panoply of Braille and large print, as we people of my age, I mean, I'm 56 for goodness sake, would have done. Technology as we know it now wasn't available then.
Yeah.
In quite the same way. So yes, I did print and then learnt Braille, which was a labour of love, or maybe not. Then kind of used some space age glasses to try and read print, which was difficult and very tiring. And then the advent of video magnifiers did make things an awful lot easier. And then as we've gone through the old DOS computers and now Windows and Apple, sorry for all the commercial references, but you know, all of those things have made life an awful lot easier and mean that I can read, which was one of the things that I used to miss being able to do easily up until about 20 years ago.
Yeah. So did you go through specialist education?
I did. I had the joys of going to the Sunshine Home at Leamington Spa. And it may have been called the Sunshine Home, but it didn't feel like sunshine, let me tell you. Then went to Wavertree School for the Blind, which is there, but in a very different guise these days. And then I had the joys, in some people's eyes, of Worcester College for the Blind, which is, of course, now New College Worcester. Mm-hmm. So, yes, went through it. I mean, I guess, you know, there are pros and cons. I mean, I think, you know, I would regard myself as, in many respects, quite confident, sort of certainly intellectually confident. And, you know, Worcester certainly filled us with that sort of confidence and academic confidence. But obviously, you know, you do miss out on an awful lot of things as well. I mean, particularly in your home community. I mean, I'm originally from Manchester, although I live in Liverpool now. And I would go home and at first, you know, your mates were quite interested. Oh, what's that like? You know, but gradually the sort of the crack moves on and they're doing different things. So after a while, when you go back home, They're no longer hanging out in the places where you used to find them, and it became a bit more of a solitary experience, sadly. But you know, I enjoyed it in parts. I mean, the education was at least accessible, and teachers had some idea, some appreciation of the challenges that we as visually impaired people faced. Although I think, I'm going to say this, I think a lot of the teachers at Worcester were just thoroughly unpleasant, quite frankly. I just thought there were one or two very good ones, but I think a lot of them didn't like children. And you kind of think, well, if you don't like children, what on earth are you doing working as a teacher? So there you go. First bit of controversy on today's podcast, folks.
So where did you move from, obviously, when you finished your school career? How did you become a journalist?
Okay, well, I did some work for a while between school and doing my degree, which I did a degree in psychology. Some people wonder why, and I say I did it because I always wonder why. But anyway, and then I did, after that, I did a postgraduate diploma in radio and television journalism at the University of Central Lancashire. While I was doing my degree, I'd always done quite a lot of writing and things, and that had been what I'd mainly focused on, to be honest. If I was going to be a journalist at all, I had assumed that it was going to be in the print media or maybe the very early set signs of online journalism. But I don't know why, but somebody said, oh, well, maybe you should think about broadcast journalism, you know, and I was, okay, maybe I'll give it a thought. And I did some work experience placements, one at the World Service in London. And then I did a few others, one at what was then GMR, now Radio Manchester. And then I got on the course, and this is a lesson to us all, actually. I phoned up the tutor at the radio journalism course in Preston. And he said to me that within about 5 seconds, he offered me a place. And I just phoned up and managed to feign real enthusiasm. You know, so I went, hello, are you Mike Green? He said, yes. And I'd really love to do your course. And he was like, in his head, he was thinking, yeah, I want this guy on the course. He can say whatever he wants now. And so, yeah, it was just, as I say, it was probably a wet, windy Tuesday morning or something. But nonetheless, I was able to summon up enough enthusiasm to blag my way onto that course. Which was a great course. I mean, I've got to say, I came out of that course really feeling as if I had many of the skills that I was going to go on to need to work in radio journalism. And it's a sign. I mean, this is many years ago now because I'm very old, but it's a sign of how good that course was that very occasionally I still think back to some of the things that Mike Green taught us. I mean, Mike was a tutor, so I probably didn't mention that. Mike was the sort of the course tutor and is a legend in his own radio program, to be honest. He'd worked in local radio in the Northwest for years and then became the tutor at this course. And he was great. You know, he was a nice guy. He understood radio backwards. And he could get it across very well. So, you know, he's a great combination of skills. And everybody loves Mike. We did manage to upset him a couple of times by making some very dodgy jingles. And the language that came out of his mouth was not broadcastable. But overall, he forgave us. And he was a great source of inspiration and encouragement. So, you know, I owe Mike an awful lot, because without him I wouldn't have been able to do some of the things I've done, I don't think.
So how easy was it to get from that course, when you said you did work placements, how easy was it to get those work placements as a visually impaired person?
Difficult, because I mean, we may go on to talk about just how difficult it is in the media for disabled people, and I think particularly visually impaired people. I had to do a lot of fast talking. which I'm doing now. And I, you know, just had to talk to radio managers, and eventually they would say, all right, come in then. You know, I've got to say, Radio Manchester GMR, they weren't hugely enthusiastic to me, if I'm going to be honest. But, you know, I just kept on at them, and eventually they said, all right, go on. And the World Service were more enthusiastic. I mean, I think, you know, because they had resources and they do things there in a very different way, they were able to say, all right, yeah, if you want to come in, we can fit you in somewhere. During the course, I had to do a placement at a radio station. So I did mine at Five Live, which, I mean, although sounds really prestigious and everything, oh, wow, you're at Five Live broadcast house. In actual fact, I don't think it really did an awful lot for me, in that I didn't really learn any radio skills there, because we were largely what's called fixing, which is just phoning guests up and getting them on and writing cues. That's introductions to pieces. But it did give me some contacts and got me in with one or two people that then subsequently got me onto the In Touch programme, Does He Take Sugar, and briefly on You and Yours. So it kind of was helpful. But I think in terms of acquiring skills, most people start in local radio. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in doing that, because you, on a day to day, hour to hour basis, you are just making radio, and you've just got to learn to work quickly, and so on and so on. Whereas at network radio, which is what Five Live is, it was very well resourced, and you might only have a couple of stories a day to do, and you'd have lots of time to do them in. So it's kind of, it wasn't easy, but with a bit of blag, and I guess the lesson is, you just don't give up, really. You know, yeah. If you want to work in the media badly enough, and you think you've got the ideas and the enthusiasm, then you do just have to carry on and not take no for an answer, to be honest.
Persistence is the key, as they say.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Persist, and persist some more. You know, if you really believe that, you know, you want to do it. I mean, if you want a steady 9-to-5 career where you earn, I don't know, whatever it is, 25, 30, 35 grand a year, and, you know, you're just going to turn up at 9, go at 5, have 3/4 of an hour for lunch, and you'll steadily progress through, then specifically as a disabled person, a visually impaired person, the media probably isn't for you. You know, but if you can cope with uncertainty, and you're flexible, I mean, this is the other thing as well. You know, what you can't be doing in the media is kind of saying, oh, I think there's a problem here, I think there's a problem there, or I can't do that, because they're just not going to be interested. You know, you do have to be able to just get up and go very, very quickly. So, and, you know, I'm just being honest, if that isn't you, then, you know, or should I say, when I say you, when I mean the people listening, then the media isn't for you, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. There are loads of other really good, honourable careers to go into. But if you, you know, as I say, if you have that flexibility and determination, and don't take no for an answer. And I guess as well, the other thing they like is people who come up with solutions, not problems, I guess. So, you know, there's a lot of different things going on there. Obviously, the key ingredient of all ingredients is ideas. You know, if you've got ideas, then, you know, you've got more chance of succeeding than if you go in just as an empty plate. You know, they want you to fill that buffet full of ideas, you know.
So do you want to talk us through what you've done since all your sort of education, and what jobs you've done? I know you mentioned In Touch and Does He Take Sugar? Mm. So do you want to give us a quick run through of all your achievements and accomplishments?
Well, okay. Quick might be difficult. It certainly varied. No, I'll try and summarise it in the way that I do on my CV, which at least I've managed to get down to 15 pages. I'm only joking. It really isn't 15 pages. Like everybody else's CV, it's 2 pages, so which means there's a lot of omissions. And lies. No, there are no lies. I kid you not. There aren't no lies. after getting the postgrad diploma, then I worked on Does He Take Sugar, did a bit of work for You and Yours, worked for Five Live for a while as a kind of researcher producer, and then worked for the regional reporting unit again as a reporter. They were all on sort of very, very short fixed term contracts. For the next few years, I worked mainly freelance for In Touch and one or two other programs. But the money wasn't great. And so I thought, do you know what? I'm going to need to at least earn some money somewhere, or earn more money. So I took a job actually working for Henshaw's, good old Henshaw's, managing the publicity there. And then I went through, had three or four other increasingly senior jobs working in central government and local authorities in communications management. In 2015, I took voluntary redundant from Lancashire County Council, where I was the media manager there, because as people will probably be aware, there are lots of cuts in the public sector, and they were keen to get rid of people and actually giving people a few bob to go. So I decided that at that point it was worth chancing my arm again at the freelance game. I worked then at Radio Lancashire for around 18 months with varying degrees of success. It was a thoroughly unpleasant place to work for reasons probably at the moment I'm unable to go into in any great detail. Suffice it to say that the BBC has done what the BBC always does, which is namely nothing in the face of extremely bad behaviour from certain people. But nonetheless, I mean, it was there's some very nice people at Radio Lancashire, despite one or two difficulties. And, you know, I think I learned an awful lot about how radio works at that real ground floor level. I subsequently then did some more work for In Touch, and I've actually, it's been a sort of ongoing theme in my life, In Touch, really. You know, I've probably been associated with or worked for the programme for 20 odd, not far off 30 years. I did some work for Thomas Pocklington Trust, the less said the better. I'm not going to go into an awful lot of details there either, I don't suppose, but suffice to say, again, there are legal reasons why I can't go into an awful lot of detail on that, but that was a very interesting episode in my life. And subsequently, really, though, I've expanded and now, until fairly recently, was a regular on In Touch, although cuts have meant that they can't use anything like the same number of freelancers. The BBC kind of hovers in the background, but I do other things now as well. I do some work for Liverpool Football Club for their charitable arm, doing communications training with young people and people in prison. I work for a company called Just Different, which teaches children about disability and being different, which is I guess implied in the title of the company. What else do I do? I've recently been accepted as a member of the employment tribe, a non-legal member of the employment tribunal. So I'm hoping that will result in work. I mean, that just started just as lockdown began. So, you know, which is a bit of a shame. During lockdown, I've made a lot of podcasts, as people on VI Talk will probably be aware, or some people will. Yes. You know, yeah, I mean, but some of those were for the BBC. I've had a very small amount of work from my local radio station, Radio Merseyside, as well. So it's kind of, I think the trendy term for what I do these days is a portfolio career. Right. You know, I think what it means is it's a hodgepodge of bits and pieces, which I quite enjoy. I mean, obviously, I trained in radio and television journalism, and that ultimately is what I at least wanted to do. But, it, you know, it's turned out to be extremely difficult, and I'm very happy to discuss generally what I think the problems are.
Yeah, that's absolutely fine. Because, I mean, we should mention just before, you've got your own company, haven't you? It's Walk on Water, isn't it?
It's Walk on Water PR, yeah. I'll tell you briefly how that came about. I used to work with a guy whose surname was Bywater, and we discussed the possibility of working together. So when you put the two names together, you get Walker, Bywater, Walk on Water, and so on. So that's where, briefly, that's how that came by. But yes, I do that. And I've got my website and all the rest of it, walkonwaterpr.com, just in case people are stuck for something to do and bored. All the podcasts are on there as well, by the way. Most of them are. I'm not organised enough to get them all on. In terms of the BBC, okay, well, or the media, I think there are huge issues in the media in relation to diversity right now. We see it in, obviously, the Black Lives Matter campaign and people talking out. David Olusoga has today written a piece in The Guardian saying how difficult it's been for him as a black person in the media. My view is it is extremely difficult for people from the black and Asian minority ethnic communities, but nothing like as difficult as it is for for disabled people, visually impaired people. I think the discrimination we experience in the media is just absolutely appalling, it's rampant and endemic, and nobody does anything about it at all. And when I was saying that, you know, if you perseverance, you need to have, you not only need to be to persevere if you're a disabled or visually impaired person trying to get into the media, you probably need to be 3 or 4 times better than your nearest able-bodied competitor to stand a chance. And that, you know, people might be surprised by that, because of course, when you listen to the radio, you hear a very nice friendly voice usually coming out of the speaker, occasionally me, and I hope I sound reasonably friendly on the radio, and I am in real life too. But, you know, joking aside, you know, you will hear this very nice friendly voice coming out of the speaker. The reality behind the scenes, unfortunately, is very different. It's extremely competitive. And anybody they perceive as a disadvantage to them, as an impediment to producing good radio or television, will not get a look in. You know, if you're going to bring them problems, they're not going to, they won't look at you for very long. And I think the perception of us as disabled, visually impaired people in the media is that we are the passive recipients of benefits, and that we are the subjects of their stories. And we certainly don't, we're not equals. They don't expect to work alongside us. So it's kind of like, not, we hear often the term glass ceiling. Well, for disabled people trying to get into the media, there's a glass front door, glass ceiling, and glass everything else as well, and it's bulletproof or nearly. So, you know, I'm not trying to put people off getting into the media by saying this, but I just think the reality is very different from the perception a lot of the time. I mean, that said, though, I mean, I've had some good times, and I don't want people to run away with the idea that it's been all dreadful. I think I've had quite a lot of, so I've made thousands of pieces for radio, not just for In Touch, but for, you know, other, for mainstream radio as well. So it hasn't by any means all been bad, but I think at the moment it's particularly difficult.
Mm. I mean, the job situation is difficult anyway, isn't it, for a visually impaired person?
It's dire.
So add to that something that's, I suppose, yeah, like media, which is very competitive, isn't it?
Mm. It is very, it is. I mean, it's
and
difficult.
And cutthroat, isn't it?
And very cutthroat, absolutely. I mean, I think that the job situation at the moment for everybody is difficult. For visually impaired people, it's doubly, trebly difficult. I mean, you know, we know the figures. And, you know, 75% of visually impaired people, so they say, are unemployed. I suspect it's probably higher. But let's stick with 70. Even if we stick with 75%, that is incredible.
Huge numbers, isn't it?
It is a huge number, and you know, and what concerns me, if I'm allowed to say this, I think organisations in the VI sector need to give the lead on this in a big, big way. You know, we, for instance, in my view, there should not be a fully sighted CEO of an organisation in the visual impairment sector. I think every chair of trustees for in our organisation should be visually impaired. You know, I just think that that is just for a starter. But more generally, the VI organisations as well should be taking the lead and showing what can be done by employing disabled people and visually impaired people at all levels right the way through. And just one other point on that. If an organisation is appointing an able-bodied person, what they do is they appoint on potential. You know, so they will get somebody, they'll get John Smith, who's able-bodied, and they'll say, well, John doesn't have the accounting skills, but he can develop them. Okay. What they do with us, and the VI organisations, in my view, do this just as much, is they say, John doesn't have the accounting experience. That's a shame. He'll have to come back when he's got that experience. And so what organisations do is they don't appoint us on potential. We have to have every skill and tick every box. And if we don't, we won't get that job. And that's one of the ways discrimination occurs. There's lots of other ways as well. But that's one way. The Equality Act and Disability Discrimination Act often come up in conversations when I talk to visually impaired people about employment. You know, but what a lot of employers have done is they've learnt to fireproof themselves. So when they recruit, they can be, you know, they can appear ostensibly to be obeying the law, but actually in reality they're not. They're still excluding disabled people, but it's really hard to prove it. And just, I think I said that was the final point. There's one other point. If you believe you've been discriminated against, unless you're very wealthy or somehow or other managed to get support from a moneyed organisation, you can't pursue it anyway. So the law is it's a completely paper tiger, quite honestly.
Gosh. So.
Sorry, I've taken up an awful lot of your time already, but you know, I just got so much to say. I didn't realise I had so much to say.
That's fine. That's absolutely fine. And I think it's great that you've been really honest. You know, that you're saying that yes. You know, I think you've got to be very passionate, haven't you, to go into media? I guess what you're saying, you've got to be passionate. You've got to be quite thick-skinned. You've got to have broad shoulders, and you've got to be as stubborn as a mule, haven't you? Really, to keep battering away and keep going.
You're right, and I think. You know, I think, yeah, broad shoulders, thick-skinned, stubborn. I think you're absolutely right. Because, and this happens to any, this isn't a disability thing. There is no end of people in the media who will tell you, you are rubbish. You know, and it happens all over the, I won't swear, that was rubbish. That was, oh no, he's hopeless, he is. She's, oh God, what on earth is she doing on the radio? And it happens all the time. People rubbish each other all the time. So yeah, you do have to be very, very thick-skinned. And one of the problems that I would say we as visually impaired people have is, when are people just saying it because they always say it? And when are they saying it because, you know, they're attacking us for being disabled or visually impaired? And it's very, very difficult to sometimes to know the difference. But, you know, those of us who've been around for a while tend to know the difference. You know, we can tell when people are having a go at us because we're visually impaired, or just saying, look, you could have done that better. And, you know, who doesn't? We all want constructive criticism.
Yeah.
So what's the future for you at the moment? What are you planning, or what are you in plans at the moment?
No major plans, really. I tend to just live life much more off the cuff these days than I used to. I mean, but 10 years ago, obviously, I would have known I was, you know, going to be in work and maybe looking for promotion and stuff like that. Now, I just take each day pretty much as it comes. I just take work as it comes in and turn it around. I've just been working on a fairly major podcast for somebody today. I've got one or two of my own projects that I'm also working on. as well. A couple of writing projects that I'm trying to get near the end of. They've taken quite a long time. I think in the short term, I'm hoping that the work for Just Different comes back on stream. I mean, that involves going into schools, and as people will know, there's a lot of controversy at the moment around children going back to school and whether people should be wearing masks. And so it's kind of how we can reassure people. I'm hoping that the employment tribunal work will start to kick in again fairly soon, because we're talking about doing that remotely. So there are no COVID implications for that, really, other than obviously doing it on a, you know, computer screen rather than sitting in a court. So I'm hoping that will come back on stream fairly soon. But, you know, I think these days for me, I just kind of take each day as it comes. I look at my email, see if people are asking me to do things. And if they are, then great, you know, and I get on with them. But I don't have any big ambitions or anything. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to run any organisation or anything like that. I think those days are those days are thankfully gone. I much prefer now my freelance life, because you're not dealing with all the nonsense of and the politics with the small p of working in an organisation. And, you know, I was talking to a mate of mine who works at a university earlier today, and, you know, they've been told that all sorts of changes are going to take place. They've got no say in them. That could have implications for their pensions, the way they work, how students are going to be brought in. And you know, it just sounds, the more I hear about people who are in full-time employment working for organisations, the more I think, thank goodness I'm not caught up in that. Because the one thing I'm probably not very good at, and this has probably cost me, and I'm being very honest when I say this, I'm not really good at keeping my gob shut.
We'd never have guessed.
No, absolutely. So it's, you know, if somebody tries to run some BS past me, I'm not very good at just kind of saying, oh yeah, great, smiling and going, isn't that fantastic? That's lovely. Yeah, we're gonna make 20,000 people redundant. That's fine. Well, that's a great thing to do. I'm not good at that, you know, to be absolutely honest. And you know what? Yes, it's probably cost me a few quid over the years. It may have cost me the odd job or two, but you know, I think integrity is still worth something. I think if nothing else, you know, and it probably doesn't buy many pints in a pub, but I'm a man of integrity, honest. I shouldn't.
That should be that way, though, isn't it?
As I get older, I think so. I mean, I've got the experience now, I've done the work. So if people want me, they know where I am. walkonwaterpr.com. Did I mention that?
You did.
I won't give my phone number out because, there'll be people queuing around the block trying to get hold of me, I think. So I won't give my phone number out, but it's on that website somewhere, I think.
Okay. Thank you so much, Tom. It's been a pleasure.